A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's wife Hannah is replacing her OnePlus 3. That phone came out in 2016. It's a decade old. She's an architect. She runs a business. She has tens of thousands of photos she's never going to delete. And she wants a great camera, long battery, a ton of storage, and two phone lines. She's not a tinkerer. She wants something that works. Daniel also wants to know about on-device AI and voice transcription, and whether any Android phone has LiDAR for her architecture work. And the whole purchase is happening during a short window in the US, but the phone has to live on Israeli carriers. He wants recommendations at $300, $500, and $1,000, with a clear explanation of what the extra money buys.
The SIM situation is the thing we have to address before we even get to models, because it's the trap that could make the whole purchase useless. Daniel mentioned two physical SIMs and said he knows that's increasingly not on offer. He's right, and it's worse than he thinks.
Hell bad.
The Pixel 11 series launched 8 days ago. It's eSIM only in the United States, no tray at all. Two eSIM profiles active simultaneously, up to 8 stored. But if Hannah walks into a Best Buy and buys a US Pixel 11, there's no slot to put her physical SIM in. The Pixel 10 series was the same. The only US Pixel that still has a physical tray is the Pro Fold at $1,900.
So the current Google flagship is a non-starter for someone walking in with two plastic SIM cards.
Correct. Now, the good news that diffuses most of this, every Israeli carrier supports eSIM as of 2026. Pelephone, Cellcom, Partner, HOT Mobile, Mature eSIM, Remote Swaps, the whole thing. Golan Telecom, too, even as an MVNO. So the destination network can handle eSIM. The practical issue is getting the physical SIM converted to an eSIM profile, which for business lines and some prepaid plans still means a call center or a store visit rather than a 10-minute in-app activation.
And the Samsung side?
Less uniform. U.S. market Samsung flagships have trended eSIM only in recent generations. A U.S. unlocked Galaxy S26 Ultra is dual eSIM, not tray, plus eSIM. You have to check the exact SKU. The one thing you absolutely must not do is buy a carrier-locked phone from Verizon or T-Mobile and assume it'll work. Those often lack the right LTE and 5G bands for Israeli carriers. Band 28, the 700 MHz APT band, is a common missing one, and that's what gives you rural and in-building coverage.
So the rule is, buy unlocked, direct from Google or Samsung, and verify band support before you fly.
And if Hannah needs a physical tray, if converting both lines to eSIM during a short US trip is too much friction, that immediately eliminates most of the current US flagship market. Which points us toward last-generation devices, or the mid-range, where physical trays haven't been killed off yet. That's actually convenient, because the price points Daniel asked about line up perfectly with that.
Let's start at $300. What's the phone?
Samsung Galaxy A56. This is Samsung's mid-range workhorse, physical SIM slot plus eSIM, so it handles the dual-line requirement out of the box. 50-megapixel main camera with decent low-light performance, 5,000 mAh battery, and, this is increasingly rare, a microSD card slot. The base storage is 128 gigs, but she can drop in a half-terabyte card for $50 and never think about storage again.
That expandable storage matters for someone who accumulates photos and never prunes them. What's the catch?
The camera is good, not great. It lacks a telephoto lens entirely, so any zoom is digital crop. The computational photography, Samsung Scene Optimization Night Mode, is a generation behind what the flagships do. In good light, it'll produce perfectly usable architectural shots. In low light, shooting drawings indoors, it'll struggle more than the phones we're about to discuss. On-device AI is minimal. Samsung reserves most Galaxy AI features for the S series. Voice transcription works, but it's not optimized the way it's on a Pixel. Fudo keyboard performance will be fine, not snappy.
So the $300 tier is, you get dual SIM with a real tray, you get battery life that'll easily clear a day, you get expandable storage that solves the photo hoarding problem permanently, and you get a camera that's a massive leap over a 10-year-old OnePlus 3 but won't compete with current flagships. The AI features Daniel cares about are largely absent.
And for Hannah specifically, the microSD slot might be the killer feature. 50,000 photos sitting on a card that can be moved to the next phone without any cloud management, without any setup. That's the 2016 workflow she's comfortable with, and the A56 supports it natively.
Let's move to 500. This is where it gets interesting, because the Pixel 10a was $499 at launch, and the Pixel 11 just dropped, which means the 10a is now discounted. What does that get her?
The Pixel 10a is, in my view, the sweet spot for Hannah. The camera is class-leading at this price. Google's computational photography is the best in the business. Magic Eraser, best take, the whole suite. A shot of architectural drawings in uneven indoor light will come out better on the 10a than on the Galaxy. A56 full stop. It's not close. You get a 256GB storage option, which is enough for tens of thousands of photos even without a microSD slot. Dual SIM is one physical nano, SIM plus eSIM, and this is crucial. The US model of the 10A does have the physical tray. The Pixel 10 series went eSIM only for the flagships, but the A series kept the tray.
So she can keep one physical SIM and convert the other to eSIM, which is much less friction than converting both.
On-device AI is where the Pixel pulls ahead. The Tensor G5 chip runs Gemini Nano locally. On-device transcription, smart reply, call screening. Google's Recorder app does on-device transcription with search, and it's fast. For Hannah's voice transcription needs, this is the phone. Daniel's Futo keyboard performance issue on his OnePlus. That's almost certainly a chipset problem. Older Snapdragon without the AI acceleration cores, the Tensor chip handles that kind of workload smoothly.
Aduri?
Solid all day. Typically around 4,700 milliamp hours on the 10A. Not the 7,000 plus you get on some of the Chinese flagships, but Google's optimization is good. She'll get a full day unless she's doing heavy video recording.
And the non-tinkerer factor. You said the Pixel Setup Wizard is the best in the business.
It is. The Switch to Pixel app walks you through transferring data from the old phone, even a 10-year-old OnePlus, step by step. Setting up dual SIM is clear. There's no bloatware, no Samsung account required, no duplicate apps. It's the closest thing Android has to an iPhone-style out-of-box experience. For someone who finds technology frustrating, that matters.
The trade-off at 500?
No telephoto lens. The 10A has a great main camera and an ultra-wide, but no optical zoom. Storage isn't expandable. 256 gigs is the ceiling, and if she fills it, she'll have to offload to Google Photos or a computer. And the Tensor G5, while excellent for AI workloads, is behind the Snapdragon 8 Elite in raw performance. For Hannah's use case, that probably doesn't matter. She's not gaming or editing video, but it's worth noting for longevity.
Now, the $1,000 tier. What are we looking at?
Two clear candidates. The Pixel 11 Pro at $1099 or the Samsung Galaxy S26 Ultra. Both are eSIM only in the US, so she'd need to convert both lines. But the cameras on these things are extraordinary.
Break down the Samsung first.
S26 Ultra. 200 megapixel main sensor with an f1.4 aperture. That's about 47% more light than the previous generation. 50 megapixel ultra wide. A 10 megapixel 3x telephoto, and a 50 megapixel 5x telephoto. Dual telephoto gives it the most flexible zoom range of any Android phone. For an architect, that zoom flexibility is useful. Photographing building details from the street, capturing facade elements you can't get close to. 8K video, 5000 mAh battery with 60 watt charging. Storage goes up to 1 TB, and US pricing has been falling. The 512GB model has been spotted around $925.
And the Pixel 11 Pro.
Announced 8 days ago. Tensor G6 Gemini Nano about 25% faster than the G5. The headline camera feature is Magic Capture, a one-swipe mode in the camera app. Circle to Search now works live from the camera viewfinder, which is a neat trick for identifying building materials or architectural styles on the fly. Google's pitch is consistency. The shot is right the first time without fiddling. That maps directly onto a non-technical buyer. Best-in-class on-device AI and voice transcription. The trade-off, reported consistently, Tensor has fallen behind Snapdragon on raw performance and multi-year longevity.
So the $1,000 question, what does the extra $500 actually buy Hannah over the Pixel 10a?
Three things. One, the telephoto lens, optical zoom that the 10a simply doesn't have. Two, better low-light performance from larger sensors. Three, more storage headroom, 512 gigs or a terabyte versus 256. Everything else, the AI features, the transcription, the overall experience, is very similar between the 10A and the 11 Pro. The 10A runs the same Gemini Nano, just on a slightly slower Tensor. For Hannah's specific use case, I'm not convinced the extra $500 buys a meaningful improvement, unless she's regularly photographing buildings from 100 meters away and needs that telephoto.
I think the telephoto is the hinge. If she's an architect who documents site visits, standing across the street, zooming in on cornice details, capturing window mullions from ground level, the telephoto pays for itself. If her photography is mostly interiors, drawings, and close-up detail shots, the 10A's main camera is more than enough.
Agreed. And there's a third option at this price point worth mentioning, the OnePlus 15. TechRadar's best overall Android right now, even though Samsung takes the camera crown. 50 megapixel main, 50 ultra-wide, 53x telephoto. 32 megapixel front camera that beats Samsung on selfies. Snapdragon 8. Elite Gen 5, 16 gigs of RAM, and a 7,300 mAh battery, much larger than the Samsung. Cheaper, too. And Hannah is already in a OnePlus household, so it's the least disruptive upgrade path.
Does it have a physical SIM tray in the US?
That I'm not certain about. OnePlus has been less aggressive about killing the tray than Google and Samsung, but the US model needs to be checked against the exact SKU. If it has the tray, and if the price lands around $700 or $800, it's a strong contender between the $500 and $1,000 tiers.
Let's address the two questions Daniel raised that cut across all price points. First, LiDAR. You said the answer was definitive.
No Android phone has LiDAR. As of mid-2026, it remains an iPhone Pro exclusive. Has been since the iPhone 12 Pro in 2020. Apple uses a true time-of-flight laser scanner that creates a 3D mesh of a room in seconds. Android depth sensing uses ToF sensors or stereo cameras through AR Core, which infers geometry from the camera feed plus gyroscope and accelerometer. Accuracy depends on lighting, surface texture, and a steady hand. It's not equivalent.
What does that mean for an architect?
The architecture-relevant scanning apps mostly assume Apple. Magic Plan, Polycam's floor plan mode, Apple's own Measure app. They rely on the LiDAR sensor in the iPhone Pro line. Manifold runs on Android, but its floor plan scan uses Apple's Room Plan API and requires an iPhone 12 Pro or newer. That's a hardware requirement with no workaround. Polycam does run on Android and is the usual recommendation for architects wanting 3D model exports, OBJ, GLB, USDZ, FBX, with a free tier and a pro plan at $20 per user per month. But on Android, without LiDAR, it's working from the camera feed.
So, the honest framing is, on Android, a phone measuring app is a fast estimating tool, not a substitute for a tape measure.
Right. If LiDAR-grade capture is actually needed for her work, the hardware path is an iPhone Pro, and that should be said plainly, even though everything else we're discussing is Android.
The second cross-cutting question, on-device AI and voice transcription. You said Pixel has a clear advantage.
Google's Recorder app is the killer feature here. On-device transcription with search, real-time, no cloud processing required. Gemini Nano enables real-time transcription in third-party apps. Samsung's Galaxy AI offers similar features, but some processing is cloud-dependent, which means latency, and it means it doesn't work offline. For Hannah's voice transcription, Pixel is the better choice at every price tier. The Tensor chip was designed for exactly this workload.
And Daniel's Futo keyboard performance issue?
Almost certainly a chipset bottleneck. The OnePlus 3 shipped with a Snapdragon 820 and 3 gigs of RAM. That's a decade old. Modern on-device AI models, even the compressed ones that run on a keyboard, need the neural processing units that started appearing in phone chips around 2018. The Tensor G5 and the Pixel 10a has a dedicated AI accelerator. The Fudo keyboard should run smoothly on it. I can't guarantee it without testing, but the hardware is night and day.
There's a storage management question that's been lurking under all of this. Daniel said Hannah has tens of thousands of photos and never clears them out. What actually happens when you put 50,000 photos on a modern phone?
The misconception is that any Android phone can handle that without slowing down. It can't, not without help. The file system overhead of indexing 50,000 images is real. Google Photos handles this best because it offloads to cloud even when you're not actively managing it. The on-device thumbnails stay small, and the full-resolution images live in the cloud. Samsung does something similar, but it relies on OneDrive integration, and you have to set it up. If Hannah won't set up OneDrive, and Daniel's description suggests she won't, then the Samsung storage management advantage disappears.
So Pixel wins on storage management by default, because Google Photos is baked in and doesn't require a second cloud account.
And the microSD slot on the Galaxy A56 is the alternative approach. It sidesteps the whole problem by giving you cheap, removable storage that doesn't clog the internal file system. Different philosophy, same practical result.
The non-tinkerer factor is worth pulling out as its own thing. Daniel was explicit. She isn't rooting anything. She doesn't want a project. She can find technology frustrating. What does that rule out?
It rules out anything that requires manual configuration to work well. The OnePlus 15, for example, great hardware, but Oxygen OS has gotten more aggressive with background process management, and you sometimes have to dig into settings to keep apps from being killed. That's exactly the kind of friction Hannah doesn't want. Samsung's setup wizard is cluttered. It pushes Samsung accounts, Samsung Pay, Samsung Health, a whole ecosystem she doesn't need. The Pixel setup is clean. Sign in with a Google account, transfer data, configure dual SIM, done.
And the dual SIM configuration itself, how hard is that on a Pixel for someone who's not technical?
The Pixel setup wizard detects the physical SIM automatically. For the eSIM, it prompts you to scan a QR code from your carrier or enter an activation code. Israeli carriers provide these through their apps or customer support. The whole thing takes maybe 10 minutes if both lines are ready to go. The gotcha is that business lines and some prepaid plans may require a call to the carrier rather than in-app activation. If Hannah's business line is with Cellcom or partner on a business plan, she should call them before leaving the US and get the eSIM QR code emailed to her.
That's a concrete, followable instruction. Call the carrier, get the QR code, have it ready before you set up the new phone.
And if she's keeping one physical SIM, even easier, pop it in, scan one QR code for the eSIM, done.
Let's pull this together into actual recommendations. Three tiers, name models, what the money buys.
At $300, Samsung Galaxy A56. The thesis is expandable storage and a physical SIM tray. She gets dual SIM with no eSIM conversion required, a microSD slot that solves the photo problem permanently, a 50 megapixel camera that's a huge leap over her OnePlus 3, and a 5,000 mAh battery. What she doesn't get, telephoto, advanced AI features, or best-in-class low-light performance. This is the pragmatic choice if budget is firm and she wants the least setup friction.
At 500, Pixel 10a. The thesis is the camera and the AI. Best computational photography at this price. On-device Gemini Nano for transcription. A clean setup experience. And one physical SIM slot plus eSIM. 256 gigs of storage is enough for now. But she'll eventually need to offload to Google Photos. This is the recommendation I'd make if she were my sister. It hits every priority without overspending.
At 1,000, Pixel 11 Pro or Galaxy S26 Ultra. The thesis is the telephoto lens and storage headroom. If she's photographing buildings from a distance, the zoom pays for itself. If she wants half a terabyte or more of onboard storage, this is where you get it. Both are eSIM only in the US, so she'd need to convert both lines. The Pixel wins on AI and transcription. The Samsung wins on zoom flexibility and raw camera hardware. For Hannah specifically, I'd lean Pixel 11 Pro. The consistency of the camera, the transcription, and the clean software experience align with everything Daniel described.
The OnePlus 15 is the wild card between 500 and 1,000. If the US model has a physical SIM tray and the price lands around 700 or 800. But for a non-tinkerer who wants it to just work, I'd still pick the Pixel.
Agreed.
So the question becomes, Actually, let me back up. There's something we haven't addressed. The Pixel 10a launched at $499. The Pixel 11 just dropped. What does that do to the price?
It pushes the 10a down. Google always discounts the previous generation when a new one lands. The 10a was already the value king at $500. At $400 or $425, which is where I'd expect it to settle in the next few weeks. It's almost impossible to recommend anything else for Hannah's use case.
That timing matters. Daniel said they're in the US for a few weeks. If they're buying right now, the 10A might still be at full price. If they can wait even 2 weeks, the discount kicks in.
If they're at Best Buy or the Google Store and see the Pixel 11 on display, the temptation will be to buy the shiny new thing. But the 11 is ESIM only, and that's a genuine headache for someone walking in with two physical SIMs from Israeli carriers. The 10A has the tray. For this specific buyer, the older phone is actually the better fit.
That's the core insight of this whole exercise. Newer isn't always better when you have specific constraints. The phone industry has moved toward eSIM-only and cloud-dependent workflows. Hannah's use case is a 2016 workflow with 2026 expectations. The recommendations that work are the ones that bridge that gap.
It's more common than you think.
Chiz, what is...
The OnePlus 3 owner who never deletes anything. I spent a year doing phone migrations at a small carrier in the UK, 2014-2015. People would walk in with phones so full the settings app wouldn't open. The OnePlus 3 was the worst because it had this dual SIM mode that half the owners never figured out. The tray had to go in a specific orientation, contacts up, notch toward the top, and if you got it wrong, the second SIM just didn't show up. No error message. It looked like it was working. I migrated dozens of them, and at least a third of the owners had been running one SIM for years without knowing it.
That's a horrifying detail.
The point is, you're right about the storage thing, but the scale is wrong. 50,000 photos isn't a problem for a modern phone. The Pixel's file system can index 100,000 without breaking stride. The problem is the migration. 10 years of photos on a phone with a USB 2.0 port. That transfer is going to take hours, and if the cable disconnects halfway through, you start over. I've seen it. The cable is the thing that fails. Use the switch to Pixel app over Wi-Fi, not the cable. The cable is a trap.
Wi-Fi transfer for a decade of photos. How long are we talking?
3-4 hours. Start it before dinner, check it after. Don't touch either phone while it's running.
That's useful. The cable versus Wi-Fi thing isn't something I'd have thought to flag.
The other thing nobody tells you, Google Photos will try to back up everything during setup. If she's on hotel Wi-Fi with 50,000 photos, it'll saturate the connection for 2 days and nothing else will work. Turn off backup during the transfer. Turn it on after, when she's back in Israel, on a connection she doesn't care about.
That's the kind of detail that only comes from having done it 100 times.
I did it more than 100 times. I still have the transfer log spreadsheet somewhere. The OnePlus 3 was row 47 through about 110.
I want to connect that to something we said earlier. The non-tinkerer factor. The person who walks into a carrier store in 2014 with a phone so full it won't open, that's exactly who Daniel is describing. And the industry has only made it harder for that person. eSIM only, cloud first, no micro SD. The assumption is that everyone is comfortable with digital housekeeping. Hannah isn't, and that's fine. The phone should work around her, not the other way around.
That's why the Pixel 10a is the answer. It does the housekeeping for her. Google Photos offloads to cloud automatically. The setup wizard holds her hand. The AI transcription just works. She doesn't have to learn anything new.
The 10a is the right call. The Samsung has the micro SD slot, but she won't use it right. She'll fill the internal storage first and then wonder why the phone is slow. The card will sit empty for 2 years. I've seen that too.
That's a very specific prediction.
It's not a prediction. It's a pattern.
The cutting room floor detail I wanted to mention. The OnePlus 15's battery. 7,300 mAh. That's almost double the Pixel 10a. For someone who forgets to charge, that's a real quality of life improvement. It doesn't change the recommendation. The Pixel's camera and AI and setup experience still win, but if battery life were the top priority, the OnePlus would be the pick. It's the one dimension where the Pixel is merely good, not great.
Which leaves us with an open question. The SIM tray is dying. Apple killed it in the US with the iPhone 14. Google killed it in the Pixel 10 and 11. Samsung is following. In 5 years, will there be a single flagship with a physical SIM slot? And what happens to users like Hannah? People who just want to move their existing SIM card from one phone to the next without a support call and a QR code.
The industry answer is that eSIM is better. Instant activation, no physical card to lose, more secure. And for most users, that's true. The people who fall through the cracks, international travelers, dual SIM users on business lines, people who buy phones in one country and use them in another, they're the ones who feel every bit of friction the industry decided to ignore.
For Hannah, the answer right now is the Pixel 10a. $500, maybe less with the Pixel 11 discount. One physical SIM, one eSIM. The best camera at the price. On-device AI that actually works. And a setup experience that won't make her want to throw the phone out the window. If the telephoto matters, step up to the Pixel 11 Pro and convert both lines to eSIM before leaving the US. The $300 Galaxy A56 is the fallback if budget is firm. It'll do the job, and the micro SD slot is a genuine advantage for someone who never deletes photos. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingtop, this has been My Weird Prompts. If you have a phone buying decision with impossible constraints or any tech problem that shouldn't be this hard, send it to us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll do the research so you don't have to. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.